So we're almost 3 weeks into our winter retreat and getting well acquainted with dukkha. And hopefully there's some sukha as well, so suffering and happiness. And there can be, you know, a lot of expectations about what, even though we're in it now, there can still be a lot of expectations of what should be happening or shouldn't be happening. When we have what we call a good meditation, then we think we're onto something, and then we just seem to fall down into a deep valley and wonder what happened. And again, even the idea, though, of what a good and bad meditation are just based on our views, really. You know, often how we think about things or what we're really expecting, you know, what we're wanting to get. And these are just more experiences to understand and to look into, really through the eye of Dhamma, through the understanding of how the Buddha taught us. So one of the things that I think all of us who have been meditating will experience is that sense of papancha, that tendency of our minds to want to just engage in thinking, relentless thinking, as if it's like a machine that's operating on its own and doesn't stop, almost as if it's a perpetual motion machine. We don't need like any rare fuel to fire it up. It just keeps going. But we are learning how to kind of starve it and to kind of slow the motor down a bit, hopefully. And, you know, what also can arise are what's called ditti, or views. And I find it interesting that the Buddha really brought up views as quite a serious problem with our practice. But that also depended on what views he was talking about, because there are some views that are the opposite of problems. They're the solution. And so we have what he calls right view as the forerunner of the Eightfold Path, something that Lumbar Cha also talked about quite a lot, and how important it is. And so it's interesting how easy it is for us to get into our own views, our own speculations, our own understandings. And I mean, what is a view? I ask that question. What is a view? I mean, in its most basic form, it's an interpretation of experience. And that's what it really boils down to. A view is an interpretation of experience. And sometimes we interpret things that are beneficial for us, interpret our experience, and we interpret things in other directions that are not beneficial. But we definitely can say that the Buddha's teachings is not one where it is not without interpretation. So it's not that we want to drop interpretation, because we are trying to always understand what we are experiencing. And so the Buddha's teaching of the Dhamma was to put it into the context that he understood. That's what he pointed out with right view. And he had kind of essentially two types of right view that he talked about. You could boil it down to what he would say is mundane or super mundane. But the ways that the Buddha talked about right view are just essentially through seeing through the noble truths. You know, that there is suffering, there is a cause of suffering, there is desire, and there is an end to suffering that we can bring about through the ending of that desire, and that's unwholesome desire. There are wholesome desires, so we don't want to end those. And then he pointed out the path. That's when one is seeing clearly into one's experience and can highlight this, then it becomes a right view or a view that is correct or going in the right direction. But he also said that there's a view essentially around karma is the other side, that our actions have results. And so he said things like there's what's given, there's what's offered, there's what's sacrificed. He said there is mother and father, which is essentially meaning that this is not the way that one was born. Having a mother, father, and mother and father was not by coincidence. It wasn't some random act of the universe. There was karma that was involved in that, and one is involved in that karma in terms of having a special relationship with one's parents, and that there's some pre-life karma that brought that about. And he talks about, you know, that there's celestial beings, there's spontaneously reborn beings, there's all kinds of things that the Buddha's pointing to that essentially come down to the fact that there are actions and there are repercussions to our actions. There are noble beings who have realized for themselves Nibbana, and again, those are the results of their actions. So these are the views that, again, the Buddha would talk about as a right view to have. And a wrong view would be that there's, you know, that there isn't anything good that comes out of giving something, or there's nothing that happens when we give something, or there is no relationship with one's mother or father. It was just a random act, and there aren't beings who are enlightened, and on it goes. So again, he points to there's a way that we can lend our minds to what is sort of beneficial for ourselves and what is not. And so when we're in retreat, this is an excellent reflection to kind of bring up in our minds, because it can be very easy to move into views that are not beneficial for us. And when we are seeing through these noble truths, when we're really seeing that there is dukkha, that's not a small thing to recognize that in one's own experience. That's something that is very easy to obscure for us as human beings. And it can come about in so many ways that we're really just trying to disguise it for ourselves. You know, trying to find some way out of dukkha, make it not real, not exist, that I can somehow find some permanent way to not suffer. And I'm not talking by means of understanding the Dhamma, just kind of thinking like, oh, I'm not healthy, I'm going to find some way to fix that, and I'm going to get healthy, and somehow I'm just going to stay really young. We recited that, I think it was this morning, we recited, I am of the nature to age, I have not gone beyond aging, nature to sicken, I've not gone beyond sickness, I'm in the nature to die, I've not gone beyond dying. And I was thinking about that as well in terms of, it's an interesting phrase, I have not gone beyond dying. So that is the English translation, I have not gone beyond illness, I have not gone beyond aging, anything. Well, of course, I mean, who really believes that? But it just seems like a normal thing for us to believe, because we're consistently working in that direction. Like if all of us really knew every moment that we were going to die, and it could happen at any moment, there are so many things we would do differently. And so we push it aside. At least that's my experience with myself, just pushing it aside. Death, that's far off sometime. I don't have to really think about it. Or when I'm ill, it's very easy to just think, okay, when I'm better, then I'll be normal again, because this isn't normal. And all of the many, many things people do to avoid the fact that that there's absolutely complete and a complete unavoidable fact that we are always aging, but yet we kind of try to hide that from ourselves. So this is just kind of a little bit of a reminder about how what's coming up for us in our thought worlds, what's coming up for us and how we speculate about our experience. As we're meditating more and more, these aren't unusual things, just to get caught up in our views, caught up in our opinions about things, in our papancha that's like a mill. It's like one of those rotating things, like the water is rotating a wheel. And it's very hard to see that that water, we can kind of stop that water, or we can in some way get our hands around or our sense around dealing with the papancha that comes up sometimes. It's just endless thinking. But it's also important to know that we don't necessarily have control of that. You know, we can't just turn it on and off until there is quite a lot of skill in doing that. So for yourselves, just, you know, what are these things that are coming up? What are the things that are very believable? And I can just see in my own practice how this is something that's very palpable. It's very easy to feel and experience, you know, getting caught up in something. And the interesting sense is, unfortunately, how believable it becomes. You know, how the importance of a view, it takes on such solidity in the mind, and there can be very little wisdom sometimes when this takes over, and we can have an energy to ourselves that can be so strong that it's, unfortunately, if we start discussing our views with others, it can be a bit off-putting and difficult to handle sometimes. So it's not just like the views and opinions that we have are not just something we're dealing with within ourselves. They also can affect others. And so it's also important that we don't just think about this as something that we're working on for ourselves. It's also for the benefit of others. I can just think of the many humorous things that in my past that... and current experience, where it's just like, it just seems ridiculous to me now, some of that. I remember one year we have this area in the monk's room, the monk's bowl room, where we wash our bowls, and it's after a few years that I was here, it eventually became a communal system, like we actually called it the communist system. So rather than monks washing their own bowls and maybe a senior monk's bowl, we all just washed each other's bowls in a line, and different people participated in what, you know, one person was a washer, another person was a rinser, and so on. Well, at the end of that line, there's this area that would often get inundated with water, and there was, you know, these very wet towels, and I'm thinking, oh, you know, I could come up with such a better solution for this. And I designed this perfect, you know, area where the bowls and everything could go, and the water would just drain off, and all of the monastics, even down to Anagarika Andrew, knows what I'm talking about right now. But they're probably thinking, yeah, that doesn't seem that important, because it's not. But in my mind, it was brilliant and of the utmost importance. And it was something that I had to just wait until April 1st to make. And it was indeed the greatest washing stand that was never made. Because, of course, April 1st comes around, and okay, well, who cares about that now? Important things to deal with. But the interesting thing is just how important that becomes, how serious, and like, it's like, no, this is it. This really needs to be thought about. I'm convinced of this. And so we really want to try to talk ourselves out of this, when we experience it, and to really bring ourselves back to that right view that the Buddha is encouraging us towards. And all we have to ask ourselves is very clearly, am I suffering right now? You know, is there some sort of suffering in this speculation, this idea I have, this thing that I want? And then we can try to, you know, we can try to see that very clearly and then say like, okay, well, how can I get myself back on track here? And part of it is just seeing that dukkha, but also just knowing that, like, the reminder is basically like, and then what? You know, that's what we can really encourage ourselves towards. Then what? Will I be happy when that's done? Will I be satisfied? Just this evening, there was just a very simple comment made about one of the Anagarkas. I got some tea for them for him, and then he said, oh yeah, this other Anagarka was excited about having that tea. And I said, he is now. And that's just the rub. That's how it is. It's like we get excited about these things. We get excited about our new car, our new dog, whatever it is. And then it's usually like just not going to meet our expectations. We're just not going to be satisfied. And there's going to be something not quite right. And that's 100% guaranteed. There's only one thing that I think can be ultimately satisfying, and that's Nibbana. But other than that, I think really everything falls short, and it always will. But we're convinced oftentimes that it won't, that this beautiful person or this amazing food is going to be ultimately satisfying. And we're told that, you know, we're encouraged that by the world. That is the world. That's our speculation from the world. That's our understanding from the world. That's what we're encouraged by. All the advertisements that we see, chase your desire, get what you want, and get it now before others do. So we have these ways that we can really try to curb that. I think, not to beat a dead horse here or dead cat, but like there's these cats that are showing up here, and they're this has happened for many years, and I've unfortunately fallen into being like the cat whisperer or something. Just like, I just tried. I feel really bad. I had some cats when I was young, and I just kind of get really attached. And so I think everyone here has heard that. So there's been several cats. I think usually every couple of years one shows up, and then I just get some guest is like, okay, fine, I'll take the cat. And then I'm happy. And my stepmom took one. Love the cat. But the feeling I have is that, okay, once the cat leaves, I will be settled again. Because it feels like a situation that's not in control. Like I'm worried about the cat. I'm worried it's going to get harmed or hurt or whatever. And there's an imbalance there of view, of understanding. Like, well, this is natural. The compassion's good. The kindness is good. But the other side where, like, well, we do what we can do, and then we let go. You know, we let go of that control. We let go of not always getting what we want, or that nature takes its course. It doesn't mean we have to be cold-hearted, but we have to be careful of that investment in permanence, that investment in the fact that there's not going to be suffering, or just, you know, not really seeing clearly around how we're self-identifying with these things. And it's, you know, it's, I think the last thing is it was very ironic, and I mean somewhat funny in a tragic way. But cat was here a month ago. Really, I like the cat, and then got it adopted, and then just for one reason or another, just some maybe some poor decisions, and then that was it. Cat's demise. far as I know. And I remember writing to Lumpur Pasno and Ajahn Kurudamo and about it and saying, I'm done. I am done being the cat whisperer. I'm done. Less than 24 hours, another cat shows up. And cute cat. If anybody wants a cat, it's really nice. You can talk to me about it later. But this is the dukkha. It's like, okay, compassion, a sense of like care and compassion can be there. But also just knowing, like, this is a good doorway for understanding dukkha and a good doorway for understanding that sense of control we always want to have and that fear around impermanence and, you know, other beings suffer. You know, other beings do suffer, and we have to be exposed to that and to believe in some way that that's not going to happen or that where everything's going to be happily ever after. It just... that's the Buddha's main teaching. It's not, you know, just that one thing, Nibbana. That's the only happily ever after. And so we can be fooled so much with these views and it's very easy. So, you know, how do we work with that? How do we kind of try to get our minds around this sense of right view that the Buddha's teaching? We have to put an effort into it. You know, we have to really try to fight against our tendencies to not want to see that, you know, to not want to see suffering, to not want to accept it. And I said for me over and over again what suffering really is and what where it really comes from. And for me, when the Buddha talks about desire, is just that very felt experience of it shouldn't be like this. This isn't okay. It should be another way. And how often is that each day that comes up? You know, I shouldn't have done this. That was such a stupid mistake. I can't believe I said that. This person probably hates me. It's not right. I shouldn't, you know, whatever it is. It's like we have a very hard time accepting our experience and interpreting it in a way that we really can say, like, we understand the Buddha's teachings, that we've really brought them in, not from an intellectual knowledge, but actually, from a clear sense of, this is correct, this is the right way things are. I was thinking about, this doesn't have to do with anything tonight, when Ajahn Yanaka was talking about entering the hall, I was thinking about how the, you know, that there is a thing Ajahn Gai mentioned before around like wanting to kind of post signs in the monastery about like how things should be. And I was talking to another monk once and said, isn't it amazing? Like those jackets people bring into the hall and they, you know, swish, 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 and they're so loud, and it's like somebody has a garbage bag on, and it's like this, and then I'll zip, zip, and you know, you're thinking in your mind, like, you know, doesn't somebody know how loud they're being, and why are they, and then it's just like, wait a minute, like, that's not right view. Right view is like, oh, great, the Buddha's right again, there it is, dukkha, you know, this is how it's supposed to be. This is exactly how it's supposed to be. And if it wasn't that way, then we wouldn't be in this realm. There wouldn't be any Buddhism. You know, and that's the way to see it. Like, okay, cat that I thought was all perfectly adopted and went well, probably just died. You know, that was probably the outcome. And then a new one comes in. It's like, oh, all right, here we go again. Rather than, are you kidding me? Like, I just said I wasn't going to do this again. Or there's not, you know, there's not supposed to be, this isn't supposed to be happening. At least supposed to get like 2 days break or something. But, you know, it's just, it's just, that's how we can really bring in our understanding, is like recognizing, like, as we say, like understanding, or Lumpur Sumedho would say, standing under dukkha. You know, we're really willing to explore it, really to penetrate and understand it. And so when the Buddha is pointing out this right view, it's not like he's saying, like, everything is dukkha. He's saying there is dukkha, and dukkha does penetrate all experience. It doesn't mean that there's not some happiness. And he also, of course, said that there's an end to dukkha, you know, that there's that possibility of ending it. But when we comprehend that, then we're not pushing away. We don't have this experience of pushing away. And in our meditation, we can often see that, the mind pushing dukkha away. I don't want to see it. I just want to experience the breath coming in and out and feeling good. And it's just really like a 2-year-old mentality, right? I'm only happy when I get what I want, and I'm not happy when I don't get what I want, and that's just how it's supposed to be. So we can kind of not grow up for, you know, till we die, if we keep that up. And it's interesting because it's we bring it in everywhere, you know, to so many aspects of our experience. I'm supposed to have progressive meditation where I'm having deeper and deeper insights and not all this dukkha, and it should be getting better by now. Or it was so good and now it's so bad. Like, why? Wow, that's not supposed to happen. Isn't this a path? Isn't it supposed to lead somewhere? So we can get doubtful and misunderstand that, you know, that beautiful teaching from Lumbar Cha, everything is teaching us. It's not just good states that teach us. In fact, those are the ones that often don't teach us. You know, when we have this wonderful meditation, then we can get very attached to it, think this is what it's all about. How many of us got into meditation because we had one good meditation experience, and then that was it? Oh my gosh, this is so amazing. I'm just going to spend the rest of my life just getting that experience again. Which is dukkha. That's what dukkha is. How can I get this? And in our meditation, that's just how it is a lot of the time. How can I get this? I'm going to get my mind in shape. I'm going to sit down, and the mind's going to obey me this time. And so we lose a lot because we're trying to get. But when we see that clearly, that as an imposter, when we say, okay, wait a minute here, like, is that teaching me anything? You know, it's going after this pleasantness. What happens if I do let dukkha in, if I do see that as this noble truth that the Buddha is teaching about? Why does he call it noble? Why is it so, it's something that is a noble truth, something that is pervasive to all human experience? Is it true? And then we can get interested in that. We can see, like, where is the suffering here? And so much that question is very helpful for us when we're sitting down and we're going through it, and we're just can kind of stop ourselves for a moment and say, okay, I'm experiencing right view right now. I'm just constantly wanting it to be different. And so what happens is when we accept dukkha, we allow it in, we bring it in, then we have a recognition of searching for its cause, you know, really trying to see what that meant, what the Buddha meant by desire, unwholesome desires being the cause of dukkha. You know, so we could see, like, I could see, oh, okay, like this belief I had that if I thought about a dish draining tray, that was going to give me some sort of happiness. And if I built it, it was going to give me some sort of happiness. And even if I did build it, then it's helpful to kind of remember, like, no, that never, actually what usually happens is there's some unintended consequence and something is wrong, and then it's like, oh, great, that was just a ridiculous waste of time. But it's not ridiculous if we're learning. So when we can recognize that we're stuck in this papancha, we're stuck in these views, that's when we can see, like, it's not, the view isn't really the problem. It's whether we're really not willing to learn, you know, or we're seeing that we're kind of ignoring the element of dukkha involved in that, the element of right view. And we're also not seeing, as I was pointing out from the beginning of the talk, that there are results to our actions. And so we remind ourselves, like, oh, each time I have these great ideas, where do they go? You know, what is the result of that? And I can honestly see that, you know, there are some great ideas. There's no denying that. But getting attached to them or thinking that they're going to be resolving our unhappiness, it doesn't help. And so we have the opportunity to really kind of encourage ourselves to see that clearly, to see where we're entering into wrong views. We're entering into views of permanence and obsessions with our own ideas and thoughts, just pushing away dukkha. And we see that, and we're able to let go because we're reminding ourselves, yes, I have the capacity to let go. I have the capacity to make a different decision here, to change my intention, to alter my view. And sometimes we're taught that the Buddhist path is one of no effort. Sometimes you hear this in more commentarial things, later aspects of the Buddhist religion. Don't make an effort. Well, no, it's don't make the wrong effort. Like, I think it's for people overexerting themselves in the wrong way. Again, like, I got to get this. I have to get this. But when we make the right effort, then we're skillfully learning what to do when our minds go astray, and we need to bring them back. So as we continue along with this retreat, I think it's helpful to really try to examine that sense we have of this interpretation of experience, a sense of view. How are you looking at your own experience? Where is that going? Is that providing you with freedom from dukkha, or is it increasing that suffering? So I'll leave that for tonight for some words of reflection.